Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good morning, everybody. I say good morning because we're making quite an early start today here in London on a freezing cold February day. But welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast, and today's a bit of a special day because we have with us at the table here Mario Andretti, and later on we'll be talking to Brian Redman. In fact, we're going to split today's podcast into two shows for you. So this week we're with Mario, and next week we'll be with Brian. So let's get straight underway. And first of all, Mario, welcome to London. And how was last night? You were inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on your show. And last night was just a wonderful evening. I mean, there was friendship, to renew friendship there, and I was felt very, very honored to be recognized as one of the first four inductees of Motorsports Hall of Fame here in England. It's something quite new in England, I understand, but I think it's timely that motorsport personalities are recognized in this fashion. I think it's very special. Anyone that is fortunate enough to be part of this will always remember this as a very special occasion, and I'm certainly one of those.
Good. Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. That's the main thing. I got to say, actually, before we Nigel Roebuck is here with us, of course, as is our editor, Damien Smith. I should have said that at the beginning, but anyway, they are here, and they'll of course be talking to Mario. But I wanted to say right away that you endeared yourself to me greatly in 1977 when I walked up to you and said, Mr. Andretti, could I do an interview with you? I'm from Radio Victory. And you said, "You're kidding, I live on Victory Lane in Nazareth." And I thought, this is my kind of guy. And I think it's been a hallmark of Mario's career, if I may say so, that he's always been so fantastically good with journalists and the media. And it's a mark, of course, of a great professional as well, I think. Nigel, you've known Mario for a very long time. More than we want to say. What marks the man out? I mean, you know, I suppose so many different victories in so many different cars over 4 or 5 decades.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we actually met in 71, Mario, so it is a while ago. That's exactly it. I mean, you know, before Mario arrived this morning, when we were just reminiscing about this and that, I think apart from the fact that he won IndyCar races in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, yeah, which is, you know, mind-blowing when you think about it. But, yes, it was just the sheer variety. I mean, I've seen Mario drive so many different cars and so many different types of car. And, you know, the most versatile racing driver there's ever been, or ever will be.
You know, of course, I mean, everybody is talking about Michael Schumacher coming back at the old age of 41, but for heaven's sake, Mario, you were 44 when you won your fourth IndyCar championship. You were 53 when you won your last IndyCar. What's everybody worrying about?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Indeed, when I was 41, the furthest thing in my mind was retirement, quite honestly. And in Michael's situation, I think he was so accomplished, at 38 when he won his seventh. And I think it was probably correct at that time for him to figure, you know, from here on it can only go down, perhaps. Having broken all records in Formula One by such an incredible margin. but I could almost see that it was before his time to leave the the sport, because clearly you could always tell the energy, like how he expressed himself when he won, that he really loved what he was doing, and he has so much to give yet. So I'm sure that he in earnest has second thoughts.
Yeah.
When he retired, and knowing that physically he's still fit and so forth, and he takes up bike motorcycles, which is totally crazy, which is but awesome, you know, because I personally I love bikes just as much as cars, and you could see that he never really left it, if you will, and I'm sure that. On the physical side, he just kept up a very rigorous regimen. You could see that just by looking at him. And now, with the situation that presented itself with his troops, Russ Braun and company, you know, having been so incredibly successful on their own, and now with under the mantle of Mercedes. I mean, it seemed like you know, no better book could have been written, and of course he in earnest now coming back, you know, just provides the excitement that's you could almost say unprecedented now for Formula One. I don't know if any season would probably be as awaited as this one for the start in Bahrain, and I was excited last year personally. When he almost made a comeback to substitute Massa, but I think that you know whatever happened there, you know, obviously you know he had a problem with his neck and so forth, but I think his fate will show that maybe that was the best thing that could have happened to him even then, because to come back in Valencia. A track that he had never driven on, a track that you cannot test on, and a car that was not extremely competitive at the time. That showed to me a very intelligent move at best.
Well, and which he couldn't test. That was the other thing. You know, he couldn't even have a half.
Well, that's just
car,
my
you know?
Point. Yeah. You know, so he could say, well, you know, Michael, yes. I give you all the credit in the world, you know, for making that decision. And as I say, I'm sure it was, you know, his neck primarily. But even if it wasn't, he has to be totally respected for that, because that was it would not have been a good calculated move. But to come back now, in having had, you know, the opportunities testing, I think, as we speak. So to prepare this way is the correct way to go. Mm. After you've been absent for a couple of years. And again, I'm sure that he just feels, honestly, that he's back home, you know, mm-hmm. because it's so important to feel confident about your support system. And again, it's going to be exciting. And I think, I don't think he's going to surprise anyone, because I think he's expected to win, and I think he will.
Yeah. I got to say, that's the most interesting take I've heard on that yet. Last night, you said to Ron Dennis, who was also inducted into the Motorsport Hall of Fame, you said, oh, one thing I never did I'd like to have done was drive a McLaren. But we're not going to see that, Mario, though, are we?
No, unfortunately we're not, but I still have family in the game. I'm cultivating that. But no, it's a fact, actually, because when... I came out of Formula One. Let me go back. When I went from Lotus to Alfa Romeo, and Alfa Romeo with a Marlboro sponsorship at the time, I did have a choice, and I never really spoke with Teddy Mayer at the time and Ron Dennis, who were principals. But Marlboro said, you know, had told me that I would have, you know, the freedom to do so, you know, with either McLaren or Alfa Romeo. And at Alfa Romeo, I had some friends there, you know, from the past that had been with Ferrari, engineer Marelli, and I went with a heart there, because the right at the end of the 79th season, I think Giacomelli at the USGP led.
Yes,
I mean, convincingly led. And I thought Alpha was probably on its way to bring in some real results. And, you know, and I met with Principal and Mr. Massachesi, and there was so much enthusiasm. And so I made that decision. However, with the rule changes that came about the following year, where you had to go
on the hydraulic,
on the hydraulic system. Alfa Romeo and specifically Engineer Chiti at the time didn't think that that was the spirit of the rule. And so we just kept getting beaten to the ground, and that was a very frustrating time because I mean, it started out with Argentina with I think Piquet. I remember going by me like I was parked, mainly because he was on ground effects and we were not. We were like on stilts, and I could not convince the group the entire season, you know, to do anything about it. So we were trying to do it with soft springs and then Packers, you know, just an impossible
situation. But it was only
situation.
You guys, that was the point. It was only Alpha.
It was only Alpha that didn't do it. It was only Alpha that was actually legal.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what's interesting? We were testing at Paul Ricard during the season, and I said, look, we're testing. Let's just set the car up the proper ride height, proper springs, you know, the way it should be, just to prove that we're somewhere in the ballpark. We were absolutely there. Our times, all of a sudden, I was, you know, top three immediately, and I said, this is the way we need to be. And I argued that, and in fact, we were in, I remember in Zolder, and I almost went home on race morning because, I mean, it just I could tell you the story that would last 3 hours on that one. But going back to what I said about McLaren, I think if I would have made a push, there was definitely a seat open at McLaren. I probably would have stayed in Formula One several more years.
Really?
But that's the way life goes. But I was sincere about saying what I said, you know, to Ron Dennis, because indeed after that, you know, they obviously were always a player, and if they're not today, they will be tomorrow. You know, they're a company they've always been able to recover provide. Any driver that's there with the absolute opportunities to become a winner.
And I love the fact that that was the Italian coming out in you, really, a bit, wasn't it? I mean,
it truly was. I must say, that was not a very good business decision, but it was primarily one of those made from the heart. And again, it's one of those things that you look back and you could say, what if, you know?
I mean, when you drove for Ferrari, that must have been, I don't know, how can I say that something that hasn't been said before, but, I mean, Nigel Roebuck was telling me when you met the old man, and, I mean, for an Italian boy, this must have been...
Yeah, you got it, no question. It was, it's sort of the ultimate, you can call it satisfaction, in a sense, because he was an icon. You know, when I first heard his name mentioned, and as a young lad, you know, you have your dreams, and life goes on, and you grow up, and you know, you're fortunate enough to pursue your dream. Started driving, and when I was still driving my own jalopy stock car, you know, on the dirt tracks, I was thinking of Ferraris. You know, it just it's what just keeps you. I remember, you know, just on the same thought here, I'm in a midget race car. I'm about to win the third race of the day, a feature, not third feature, which I think it's never been done, and the same within the 24 hours in 1963, and I'm ready to start the race. And I don't know why. You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking of Dan Gurney in Formula One. And I'm sitting in a car. And I don't know, it's just the way my thought process was, but and you know, to come back to the Ferrari situation, you know, it's impossible until you reach a certain level, you know, in your career. But it seemed like as soon as I pretty much got there, then the contacts started happening, and when I was first invited to do so, to drive Ferrari, it was actually just amazing to me. In fact, I remember they were testing 512 at Daytona, and I think it was Arturo Merzario who was testing it. He had never seen Daytona, and he was downshifting for the banks.
You know?
So I got a call from Mauro Frugieri, and I guess I was the handiest one there to arrive, and I went down, and of course, you know, that was my introduction to them, because I had driven at that point a Ferrari for Luigi Chinetti, was the private entry.
Yeah.
Couple of years earlier, and so that was really my introduction to them, and it was actually a very auspicious one, because you know, I was totally familiar with Daytona and poor Arturo. You know, I can see, you know, that he didn't feel very well about that, but it was interesting. It was interesting that I was getting fitted up on the seat and so forth, and the mechanics thought, okay, he's Italian, but he actually is American, and he can't speak the language, so they were saying certain things, you know, in their own dialect. I mean, nothing really offensive, you know, but just, you know, just cutesy things, and Seguino and things like that, you know. And I just played it out, and all of a sudden I'm speaking with Mauro Frugieri, you know, in perfect Italian, and I could see the color of their faces change dramatically. It was actually funny, you know, proper they are. And anyway, but that was
Boy, this is great stuff, isn't it?
Yeah,
great stuff. Hey, those were the days, Mario.
Yeah, indeed.
But, you know, I mean, I always think, I mean, Pino Alievi, Italian journalist friend, still says the best day at Monza there has ever been was qualifying in 82, you know, when you came back, when they called you in to do, would you do Monza? And I remember ringing you and saying, are you going to do it? And you said, well, you know, what, are you kidding? You know, this is cream for the cat, you said at the time. And you got the pole. And that was, I mean, that was an extraordinarily emotional day. I mean, because it was the year Villeneuve had been killed, Pironi had been hurt and everything else, and Ferrari had really been through it. But then, later on, I remember you telling me in 88, when Gerhard had his accident at Imola, that Ferrari contacted you about doing Monaco, even in 88. And at the time, you said there was no possibility to test, and they had just started with the automatic gearbox.
89, wasn't it?
It was, sorry, excuse me, it was 89. Yeah, it was. It was
89. The editor speaks.
But I mean, no, but it's an amazing thing that, you know, I mean, there you were. I mean, we're talking about Michael, 41 years old. You then were almost 50, and Ferrari's first thought was still, well, you know, Gerhard can't do Monaco. I wonder if Mario might.
Well, you know, here again, you're right. There was, I think, when you talk about being invited to substitute, I think it was Pironi at the time, Monza, I had the luxury of doing proper tests. And not in Monza, you know, Fiorano, but at least become quite familiar with the car. Sure. And then, and there was something about, you know, it's coming to me now that you mention it, about that event for Monaco, that I clearly didn't think that I could do it justice, You know, after being...
He was the gearbox you were concerned
yeah,
about.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And it was Ann Monica, of all places,
yeah,
too.
That's so, exactly yeah. right. So I felt that, you know, I have to, you know, be realistic, you know, at that point. And I don't think I would, like I said, I would have had enough time to really familiarize myself properly. No. You have to remember that when I did Monza, I was only out of Formula One
yeah.
year.
Yeah.
And even though... You know, the engine configuration, everything was different. You know, it was the first time that I had ever driven turbo. You know, Formula One and so sure. forth. And sure. And those were like a real wake-up call, you know, because it was like sitting on top of a keg of dynamite. You know, the you can imagine 1.5 liter engine. And I remember the first... run that I did at Fiorano when we did the qualifying simulated qualifying run where actually the engine was to prevent detonation was water injected yeah. And they told me that it was producing over 1,000 horsepower. Now you can imagine the power you had under your butt. It was not benign power. It was either there or not. It was on. Because, you know, with an engine being so small, you know, it was all yeah. under turbo pressure. So there was nothing normally aspirated that could sweeten you into, you know, a curve that was there. But it is a driver. I mean, what a kick. Unbelievable. I mean, you could... I remember qualifying at Monza, and I actually, in fifth gear, I was doing wheel spin between the Lesmos. That's how much power there was. It's just amazing.
I guess it can't be that often that a guy with the experience you had by then still feels that in a racing car.
Well, it's very true. Yeah, it's funny you would say that because you're quite accustomed to it and so forth, and yet this was something that still you know it surprised you and you know and got your attention. And but that's those are the things that you remember because it was so impressive. I mean, it was so impressive, and that's something that the lads of today will never experience, you know. Because those, I mean, to be able to experience that type of power with a weight ratio that you had, I'm telling you, it's. I'm sure that an astronaut can probably give you an idea what acceleration is like. And we had that, you know, because and the cars at the time, you know, of course, you were lacking certain aspects of what you have today, but there were still, you know, a good ground effect. So you know, there was a lot of speed through the corners and all that. So it was a lot of it was all there.
Also, I mean, you the car wasn't exactly the safest thing in the world either, was it? I mean,
well, yes, indeed. I mean, we've come a long way in that respect. Thank goodness, you know. But but those are the issues that you were not, you know, thinking about. You know, at that was. But it's again, safety wise, we spoken with. With Nigel, some you know, at length as to how beneficial you know that sure. has become to the sport. I mean, it was essential for the sport to be able to continue, and you know, as became more and more commercial. You know,
I'm going to have to ask some. Sorry, Nigel.
Okay, no. The only thing I was going to mention was when you were talking about the you know the kick you got from the just the sheer power available in that turbo Ferrari. You said something similar, I remember, about the in sort of 72, 73 in IndyCar racing mm-hmm. with the when we had the turbo offies.
There's no limit.
But again, that was night and day, wasn't it? There was sort of a certain amount of 300-400 horsepower up to, you know, a certain point, and then bang, suddenly you had 1,100.
Right.
Well, but didn't you once tell me, in fact, you know, your front wheels would sort of momentarily...
Well,
come off the deck, could do.
And that was, yes, because qualifying.
Yeah.
In those days, as you say, like 72, 73, there was no limit
yeah.
on the boost factor. And you, the only limit was, you know, the engine exploding, obviously. But when you were qualifying, that was, that engine was just going to be good for like those two laps, and then that engine's coming out. And that's what, you know, so it was so incredibly satisfying, because you could never really experience that type of power until you were actually qualifying. You didn't have the luxury to have a test, have a go for a couple of laps, and then, okay, know what to expect qualifying. And that's where I used to love that, because it, that's when... And those, then qualifying, you'd see revs that you had never seen before, so you knew that was translating to speed. And I remember, oh gosh, it's especially when you're on an oval, because you're always high speed, and you don't really, you very seldom get to really feel the real acceleration, because you're already up at higher speeds.
Yeah, you're up there.
But when we had, you know, we were able to put that much turbo pressure, we had that much power available, then you were in earnest, really accelerating to the point of wheel spin, you know, at any time. And so that, like I said, these were satisfying moments, unbelievable.
Wow.
Because, you know, with a car with no ground effects and so forth, and like on a two-mile track, you know, I'm qualifying like in Texas at 214 miles an hour average, you know, and you certainly... not flat through the corners either, you know, you're almost braking because you're running 245 or so on a straightaway. And so, I mean, it was just, you know, incredible satisfaction, you know, for a driver to experience that.
Well, we've been, you may have heard the door opening, or possibly not, because he opened it and shut it extremely quietly. But we have been joined by Brian Redman, who was also with us last night at the Motorsport Hall of Fame. And he seated himself down opposite our editor, Damien. Welcome, Brian. Thank you very much. A man who's also knows a bit about going pretty quickly and lots of power, especially in some pretty frightening Porsches. But we'll come to that in a few moments. Mario has to leave us quite soon because he's going to have a look at London, and why not? Just to come back very briefly to the point you just made, is that Bobby Rahal said to me that sometimes he left the speedway thinking he'd just dodged a bullet. Which, I mean, you know, you can sort of understand, as I've only watched it, obviously, but
Michigan,
wow.
Michigan particularly, yeah, Bobby.
You know, it's funny you would say that, you know, but often, you know, when we talk about the safety aspect and so forth, especially, you know, in those days, it tracks that actually really I felt so thankful to leave, you know, in my own accord, were like Michigan, places like Michigan, for instance, with the high banks, where, you know, there was never a small crash. You know, if you were going to have one, it was always going to be a big one. And you know, unfortunately, you know, some of us, you know, paid the toll there, you know, and realistically, I even think, you know, on the way back to my airplane and so forth, I was just kissing my limbs, you know, everything I said, everything is with me today. We're good for another year for this one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You couldn't help it but, you know, thinking in those, even though you normally don't dwell on it, but it was that sort of situation, unfortunately, to some degree, because again, something went wrong at all. In 85, when at the end of the 500 mile race, you know, I lose a shear to the right front hub, right front wheel, and I mean, I went in so hard, and you come away, you cannot come away unscathed. I mean, I had I think there was the brake caliper right into my pelvis, you know, at that point from the right front. So, you know, that type of thing. So, you were just lucky to escape, you know, and that's, you know.
Anyway, you're here. Thank goodness.
We're here, yes. Thank you.
And so is Brian. So that's, you know, but we shouldn't really dwell on the. On that, it was a very dangerous sport in those days. Oh, well, it still can be. I must, sorry to interrupt again, but I must come to some of our readers' questions, because we've had a record number for both Mario and Brian. We've never had this many questions. And I got to say, there's no way we're going to get through them all. I'm very sorry, everybody, but we just don't have the time. But I've picked a couple here, one from David Fisher, who wants to know, Mario, about... there's two words coming up, may catch your attention. One is James, one is Hunt. He's really asking, how did you get on with James? Because I think he's thinking about Tarzan, Zandvoort.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, just one event like this, you know, sort of brings about a conversation, because I got on with James very well, no question. We had, you know, a bit of a run-in, and he had his argument, I had mine. And quite clearly, I think at that point going into Tarzan, it's one of the corners that you could, probably one of the only corners in Formula One that you could actually make a pass on the outside because of the banking. And that's exactly what I did to him. He was very... really protecting the inside, because I was, you know, obviously working on him under braking, and finally I had him down so low protecting, and I just shot on the outside. I'm alongside of him. I'm clearly alongside of him at the exit, and he totally disregarded the fact that I was there, and he just came across, and he's the one that, you know, we put each other off. You know, and then he's saying, I wasn't supposed to be there. I say, hey, I'm on the tarmac. You know, I you can't just disregard the fact that I'm there. I can't disappear. And that was the argument, you know. So
he did actually say, we don't overtake on the outside in Formula One.
Well, he made that comment, you know, and that's the point. And it was not a valid comment, because I was not in the grass. I was not, you know, on the shoulder. I was on the track. And clearly alongside him. I thought I made a pretty damn good pass. But I surprised him, obviously, and fair enough. So I take his argument, and he has to take mine. When you're competing fiercely and, for a championship, if you will, sometimes you're going to have those moments. But... in no way did I ever have any problem with James whatsoever, going on after that.
I think Brian Redman looked like he wanted to say something there. I mean, racing drivers, you overtake where you can, don't you, Brian?
Well, you do, and I have to smile at that, because the first time I ever met Bobby Ensor, who was really a USAC roundy-round racer, it was a Formula 5000 race at Pocono Raceway. And the first race of the new season, we had new Formula 5000 cars, the T400 Lola. And the car was, for some unknown reason, slow. And I come in the pits, and Jim Hall would say, what's the matter? Is it pushing? I said, no. Oversteering? No. Well, why are you so slow? I said, I don't know. So the race was cancelled because of rain. And Carl Haas, of course, who was the Lola car importer for North America and had sold probably 7 or 8 of these T400s, he did an amazing thing, and I think it, of course, Mario drove for Carl for a long time also. And Carl bought a wrecked Lola 332. The race was cancelled, it was held a month later, and in that month, the wrecked 332 was sent down to Jim Hall in Chaparral Cars in Texas and rebuilt, and we came back to the new race with a 332. Well, I was on about 8th or 9th place, you know, on the heat. We had heats in those days. So I'm in a bit of a hurry to try and get to the front, and there's Bobby Unser in front of me, and there was a tight left hand, almost a hairpin, behind the pits. And he'd left, you know, plenty of room, so I shot through this gap and did all right. And yeah, afterwards, Bobby came up to me and says, "Redman," he says, "what the hell are you doing passing me going into that turn?" I said, "Well, you left a gap there." I said, "there's plenty of room." He said, "is that the way you road racers do it?" I said, "yeah." He said, "okay, now I know."
Well, I tell you, one of the joys of having both you guys here is that, of course, you raced against each other. And, you know, we're talking Formula 5000 here. I mean, it's funny, you know, when you look back on Formula 5000, the great thing about it was it was such exciting racing, because so often, you know, what you might call today a support race is not, but it was great racing in its own right, wasn't it, Mario? I mean,
yeah, I think that, yeah, the series really seemed like it had legs at one point. Specifically, I think 73 74, if I'm correct. And the cars, typical SCCA by rule, didn't hold enough fuel to really have a good proper long race, and there was no provisions for pit stops, so that's why it never really gained prominence, because you know, you always had these two heat races, and unfortunately, it's just like world superbikes. You know, they're trying to keep them below the, I think, MotoGP, just by having the two, having them. Otherwise, it would probably, because of the sheer number even of bikes and the excitement of World Superbikes, it would have a spectacular show as MotoGP, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, it was almost the same thing. Like, they tried to keep that series, you know, to a lower level, if you will. But it was in earnest, a good racing. The cars were proper cars, quick cars, fun to drive for sure. Not the 400, I agree with you. 332, I think, was the car that really, I thought it was a balanced car. It was a fun car to drive, and we obviously were allowed good power, you know, with these American V8 engines, you know, so lap times were quick. As a matter of fact, I remember that just in 75, when we were preparing for the Formula One season with the Parnelli car, before South Africa, you know, the car was as usual, everything was late, we only had one test to do, which was at Riverside. And we had a great baseline at Riverside in a Formula 5000 car, so we had a time to shoot for. I couldn't come within, at first, a second and a half of my Formula 5000 times with a Formula 1 car. And that's what I'm saying. I said, "Hey, we're going to South Africa in a Formula 1 race." I said, "We cannot even match a Formula 5000 times." And quite honestly, it took a while. We did, you know, another test just before the car was shipped, where I only came within a half a second of my time at Riverside with a Formula One car. So I never even matched from a 5,000th time. And of course, the show, because I think in South Africa we finished, I think, fifth or sixth, you know, in a race. Yeah, yeah. But it was not going to be a front runner.
We've got both of you here for such a short time. I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump around a bit, and Nigel will correct me if I'm wrong here, but you both drove for Ferrari in 72. Good, I'm right. I mean, tell me a bit about this guys. I mean, your styles were different or similar, or tell me how well did it work?
Well, you loved the car, didn't you?
It was a great car.
312 PV.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I think, as far as a sports car, that was one of my all-time favorites because of you could just fling it around like a single-seater, you know, just the right quick gearbox and everything, great braking. I just loved that car, and that's why we won with it. You know, we just, I think it was a proper formula at that time.
Yeah.
And, it was really great, and I never drove with Brian. Brian as a teammate, you know, I mean, just together, but we, you know, we had some
things. The thing always struck me about those cars, they always seemed to be, whenever I saw them, they always seemed to be smothered in graphite grease.
Oh yes, but that was typical.
Do you remember that, Ron, or not? There seemed to be graphite grease everywhere.
Oh yes, they were. I think that in those days the mechanics, everything that they thought moved, they would lubricate with the graphite. And I remember some of my driving uniforms. We could never get them clean, you know, afterwards because of graphite. And you always came out of that car like you worked on it.
You remember that, Brian?
Yes, indeed. But actually, of course, I think at that time, Ferrari had really, you know, because the team manager was Peter Schetti, a Swiss driver who had raced and was a hill climb expert, and he was extremely calm. And in the Ferrari team at that time, there were no histrionics, you know, with mechanics throwing wrenches and that sort of thing, as they had in the past. And so it was an extremely good team, very well organized.
As a matter of fact, the only signs, pit board signs that I ever got from Peter Schetti was "slow down, slow down." That's all. Slow down. That's all we ever got.
Which is not really what you want to see, is it?
Well, you know, it was great because that means we were in pretty good position, you know. But he kept saying, "Slow down, slow down."
Yeah, in 1973 at the Nürburgring, I was driving with Jackie in fact, in 73 I drove with Jackie most of the time. In 72 I drove with Clay Regazzoni generally, and occasionally with Arturo Mazzario. And at 73 at the Nürburgring, it didn't seem like it, because by then Matra were really faster than the Ferrari. But the team manager, who was Giacomo Collieri at that time, he said, if a Ferrari is leading at the halfway point, then there must be no fighting in the team. Well, guess what? We're leading. Jackie Ickx and I are leading at the halfway point, and suddenly Arturo Mazzario comes hurtling past right in front of the pit. Now there's a battle, like, go for two laps, they go like crazy men, you know. And then we one more pit stop to make before the end, and Mazzario came in, and they ordered him out of the car. And he wouldn't get out. He'd grip the wheel, and he's staring down like this. But, you know, he was a very thin, small guy, and these two big mechanics prized his fingers off the wheel and hauled him out.
I mean, that's a great story.
Well, how did it finish? I'm trying to remember.
We won the race.
You won the race, yeah.
But also the year before, when I was driving with Mazzari and we finished second, Regazzoni and I had agreed to go to dinner with him. And you know what the old sport hotel was like in those days? It was pretty miserable. So we again banged on his door and there's no reply. Then we banged again and ciao, you know, come in, whatever. We opened the door and there is Mazzario between these two big camp followers in bed, you know, lying there. So we looked at this ensemble and
cowboy hat on.
Regazzoni said, "Girls," he said, "girls, what you do with Arturo? He is so little." And one of them says, "Yes," he said, "little, but good."
Oh, welcome to the Motorsport Family Show. If there is a slight hesitation in the tape, it may be because Brian told another different story. That's good stuff. I mean, I love all that. One thing I really miss about motor racing, I must say, is the nationalities were so strong. The German teams really were German. The Italian teams really were Italian. That seems to have gone a bit now. Do you agree, Mario? I mean,
well, perhaps. I suppose maybe now I think the mix is not as, you know, as obvious, which is, I think that's good. in that sense. But some of the rivalries that we had, you know, in those times between nations and so forth, I think I thought that was healthy.
Yeah.
You know, because a national pride, I think, plays obviously along the way. I remember, you know, you're in the States and they play a national anthem, and yes, fine, and you respect it. But I would be winning. I would win Argentina, and they would play the American national anthem and then the Italian national anthem for me while I'm on the podium, and then tears come to your eyes. You know, so it has a special meaning, I think, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, national pride, I think, is healthy for anyone, and that, you know, it's all part of it, I suppose. You know, it's part of just having that, the feeling that you're not only driving for yourself, you know, and, you know, perhaps you're trying to satisfy your fans, you know, that, sure, that pull for you, that have the same feelings.
People always said that driving for Enzo was different from driving for Anthony, because you did feel you were driving for
busted your butt just to get a bit of a smile. He was so difficult to understand, because he was always very, very just proper and he would show no emotion. You know, and you figure, what do I have to do? He certainly didn't want to crash, because you got a reaction from him there. It was one of those. It was really tough to read. I remember actually going back when I was testing at Fiorano just before Monza, and he was there all day watching, because they had, in his office, you know, they had cells where you could, he could actually watch all the cornering, and then we set a record there just toward the end of the day, you know, in qualifying form, and he did come out, and he had a bit of a smile of approval, you know, that was worth everything to me.
I tell you, I wish this was TV. Mario's just grinning like a Cheshire cat. Could have been yesterday, couldn't it, Mario?
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, Brian, you drove for Porsche a lot. And obviously, we know, you know, your Ferrari, very, very different setups, different atmosphere, yes?
Well, you'd think so, but really, Porsche in the late 60s, early 70s were very, they were disciplined, and yes, there wasn't any throwing of wrenches, but they were a fun team, you know, as well.
Really?
You know, the chief people. Even Herr Piëch from time to time. That was fun.
Yeah, I just want to, because one gets much more of a sense of fun about motor racing in general. I mean, okay, I know it was hard work to win the world championship and all those, right, sure, but you had more fun. Am I right?
Well, I think you have to have fun. There has to be even a light side of it, but you have to have fun in a sense of you can't be looking forward to something if you're not going to have fun with it. Yeah. You know, truly. So I love the idea of being able to visit the other continents of the world, you know, as well. You know, even though I never got to see anything, you know, but just the prospect, okay, I was in Malaysia, I was in South America, I was, you know, everywhere. It's South Africa and so on and so forth. I mean, all of that, yeah, it's going to stay with you. I don't think you can really endure, have a long career unless you're really enjoying what you're doing. Yeah. And that's why I think, you know, I didn't want mine to end because of that. Because there was always something to look forward to,
yeah.
And that's so important. I had personally no problem staying motivated in any possible way, mm. You know, because again, there was always just look forward to the next thing coming, and that part I thought was very healthy for me.
I wondered how you felt about when Michael came to drive for McLaren. obviously it was a great moment for him to get into the McLaren team, whether you felt that, you know, he was given the opportunities and given the kind of support that you felt he ought to have been given, because fathers and sons, it's quite a tricky...
Well, let me put it this way. I think he came to probably, for sure, one of the absolute best teams ever, except at the worst possible time, because McLaren at that time lost something that was a great advantage to them, was a Honda engine. And it was not until probably, and I think Ron Dennis will verify this, just a month or two before the first race, that there was not a decision whether it was going to be, I think, a Peugeot engine or a Cosworth. Mm-hmm. And there was no testing really to be done, except with the old car, you know, where Michael did, like, I think 2 days at Silverstone. It was wet. And he just didn't have really the time to get familiarized with anything. Then they go to South Africa, and there's a new rule. The rule of the famous rule of the
short qualifying.
Short qualifying. Yeah. You could only do every lap that you were on the track counted toward a maximum laps that you could do. So if you just had a warm-up lap, so to speak, or in and out lap, it counted down. And so there were so many restrictions, you know, on him. And, you know, Michael, I tell you what, I think he got did not get a good rap from even the motor racing press here. Because he was, Michael had the talent for sure to win in Formula One, no question about it. And I think as the season progressed, when he felt more comfortable with the car, he was, you know, he showed that he definitely belonged there. Even at Manicor, I remember he started something like 18th, and he finished in top 5, 50. You know, he knew how to pass. He had a couple unfortunate incidents, you know, by being probably overly sort of, I don't know, just...
keen.
Overly keen. at Donington, I remember he was really quite... I was watching him. I actually came... It was the first race that I watched him practice, and I went to breaking points. He had no problem. He was as quick, as late breaking as anyone, as Ayrton. Donington was wet in the morning, and he was quickest in the morning practice. And for some reason or other, there was one driver out there, Carl Wendlinger, who was, you know, a good guy, that seemed to be in front of him, you know, during the race most of the time. And he would go alongside of him and at the most inopportune time, and off he would go. That was unfortunate. But bottom line is, if he could have stayed on, you know, the following year and so forth, Michael would have brought back a championship to America again with McLaren. Yeah. No question about it in my mind. And because a lot of people say, oh, well, he was not committed. You can never tell me Michael was not committed to his game. In fact, you know, while we were talking about, you know, having fun doing it, he was actually so focused, so extremely focused on his work, that he didn't really have a lot of fun doing it. That's why his career is relatively short. Michael just he had his race face on the entire weekend. He would not go to dinner the night before the race outside. He would eat in his room and all. So anyone that tells me that he was not committed enough and was going back to the States, that's all entirely wrong assessment of him. And he was only going back to the States because he was not even allowed to test, because the third driver on the team was Mika Hakkinen, who was brought on because Ayrton Senna was going to leave.
Yeah.
And then when Ayrton stayed, Mika was there with nothing to write, so Mika was doing the testing. So Michael wouldn't even get to do the testing. And so it was kind of unfortunate situation that I don't think anything can be blamed specifically. Michael can't be blamed, and McLaren cannot be blamed. It was just a situation that happened that turned out wrong But it could have been the only thing. But it could have been righted if Michael would have probably decided, okay, I'm going to write it out. Hopefully, I will be renewed anyway, which I think he would have been, because Ayrton moved on to Williams after that anyway. But he didn't want to risk a sabbatical. Because I think McLaren said, we cannot give you an answer until about November or so. And Michael said, well, I must be driving next year. So he got himself a big deal back to the States, with Target Chip Ganassi. And then he went back. But that was unfortunate, because I think, again, Michael definitely would have made some... got some results here in Formula One.
I think the other thing about that year was, I mean, it couldn't have been a worse year either, because that was the height of the Gizmo era, when they had every single new system on them. I mean, they even had ABS that year.
Well, yeah, it's true.
And coming from IndyCars, there were just a huge number of new things for them to get used to.
Yeah, true. But again, it all comes about, with testing. Like, I'll go back to Manicure, for instance, that after the race, they tested for 2 days, mm-hmm. right after the race. And between Ayrton, and this is a matter of record, between Ayrton and Michael, there was like a tenth of a second at the end, and they both would have been in the second row of the Grand Prix, after making some, of course, some improvements after the test.
Right.
So at that point, like mid-season, he was already had his arms around it pretty good, and it was beginning to really feel very comfortable and confident. And like I said, it just turn of events that went wrong. But I think the all the elements to be able to make this thing right, were there and they were ignored.
I think it's another reminder of just how tough it is, isn't it? I mean, it's just...
It is indeed, yeah. It's never easy, yeah, sure. At any time, of course. But also I believe in fate, just in sometimes not knowingly you do the right or wrong things, and in this situation with Michael, it's so sad, to think that, okay, that was a failure where there's no way that should have been.
Sure. Sure, I understand. Well, look, I can't believe it, but an hour has gone by, and we promised to let Mario go so he can see the sights of London, our capital city. But Brian Redman has very kindly agreed to stay on. So, as I explained at the beginning, we will
be... I'll take my notes with me.
Mario's been doing a bit of artwork during the show. That'll be worth money one day. I'll have that. Thank you. Wrapping up this part, and then do join us when we'll be back with Brian Redman. Some more good conversation. But I must just thank Mario Andretti so much for coming along today. It's been a real pleasure, Mario. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.